One of the first things that I noticed was people dancing together very much respected each other's personal space. There wasn't any bumping and grinding, and you're more just dancing alone than with anybody, really.
Well, there's different clubs for the dancing you might, we're probably thinking of.
Yeah.
Do you know the kitchen phenomenon at German parties?
Yeah, the kitchen phenomenon. That's really a good example of German culture, I think so. I have quite some friends that come from Asian countries, and they found out something interesting about German parties. They said, at German parties, you never play games, no one dances, no one sings, no karaoke available, just everyone is sitting in the kitchen and discusses politics. And, well, yeah, you get the image about Germans being uptight and reserved and always being serious and discussing serious matters. And although the camp here is a little bit more laid back and a little bit more free, I think our German character is strongly showing through. Gabriel, it's the first time in Europe for you, and
yes, it is.
I believe you visited some other European country just before you came to Germany.
Yes, I flew into Amsterdam. Yeah. And I was very pleased.
You were very pleased. How come?
It seemed a very friendly place. Like, walk around, I don't know if it was just other tourists, but I'd often find eye contact, and I felt welcomed, actually. It was very nice.
And you told me earlier that you noticed that people are going around more freely, women not wearing bras because of the heat and something like that.
May have been the heat, yes.
Yeah. We have a lot of Dutch guests here at the camp. And I'm really glad that they're here because they bring that more mellow feeling to the camp. If you remember the camps that were held in Holland, Hacking at the End of the Universe in 1993, or Hacking in Progress in 1997, or Hackers at Large in 2001, these were culturally much different camps because there was a very, very friendly atmosphere there, and maybe they didn't organize things as well as we did. I didn't see a rocket like fairy dust in Holland because they were too busy having fun and going skinny dipping or whatever the Dutch people do, so they didn't have time to use their engineering knowledge to construct such a rocket. Anyway, it was a really great atmosphere. Inge, you have been to the camps in Holland as well. What did you think about them?
In Holland? Well, I think the biggest culture shock I didn't got in Holland, I did had the biggest culture shock when I went to the US.
Hmm.
Well, in the US, the situation was quite different, and maybe we talk about this after the music break. What music is next, Jens?
Next is something by Air, but I want to make a short announcement. If you have something to share with us about getting culture shocked,
oh yes, you can call us.
You can call us if you are at the campsite, and if you have a decked phone with the local telephone network here at the campsite, just dial 5555. Or if you're listening to us via stream, maybe from abroad, just dial your international access code followed by 49 for Germany and then 33438 6422 4. I can't read it. What's the last 6? So I'll say that again. Dial your international access code followed by 49 for Germany, 33438 6422 4 6, and we will gladly receive your calls. So. Thank you.
listening to Radio Sub Isar again, and well, into our discussion group there are some new guests. Hello.
Hello.
What are your names?
My name is Schatz.
And I'm Bogel.
Your name is
Schatz.
Wow, this is very low. From where are you?
We are from the sea base. We are from the sea base, and we noticed that there were many people on the camp who didn't know what the sea base was. So we thought we'd come to you to tell everyone about it. The sea base is a spaceship which has crashed onto what is now Berlin Mitte very long time ago, something about three billion years ago or so. And there is a Verein. Space station to reconstruct itself in parts.
ja, du hast diese Kultur. We are back here on Radio Sub-Ether, and we were talking about Vereins and what is a Verein in the English language. Jens, what is a Verein in English?
It's very hard to translate, mainly because there isn't an equivalent in English or in the British or American culture. It means a registered organization that works non-profit, on a non-profit basis. Actually, it goes back to the time when we had in the imperial age of Germany, when we had laws against socialists, and well, to compensate for making the socialist party illegal, the emperor introduced the concept of a registered non-profit organization. For instance, the Chaos Computer Club is such an organization. Must be very strange for foreigners to learn that in Germany even Chaos has some structure, even Chaos is registered as a non-profit organization. But for tax reasons, this is the most convenient way to run such a club in Germany.
Yeah, well, I think for the official side, it's not quite really a big difference, because in most countries you have something like Vereins, because the law side and the official side says that a Verein is nothing more than a company, but it's an own culture thing.
Yeah, almost every German is a member of one or two or more Vereine, and yeah, it's all very structured. You're forced to have regular meetings.
That's not true. It depends on the Verein.
Well, you have to vote for the board. At least in a regular way.
Yes, there are some requirements that you can stay as a Verein, but
if you look at how the 2600 meetings are run in the US, maybe Gabriel could enlighten us about that. It's much looser than in Germany.
Yes, the 2600 meetings, basically, if you've heard of them before, they're mostly just a predetermined time and place where people show up and hang out. There's not much structured activity. Maybe you hang together, talk technical talk for a few hours, go out to the bar, and end up at someone's apartment later and just do whatever fancies you. Watch a movie, hack around.
Yeah, well, I don't think that is quite big of the difference at all. Isn't a Verein just a group of people who want to do something together?
Well, this is basic idea, but in reality, people are just talking about meta things and...
Yes, if you are over-organized, but...
Yeah, but...
If you are over-organized, something is definitely wrong, yeah?
Yeah, but being German, we cannot help from over-organizing everything, don't we?
Well...
It's in our genes.
I saw enough chaotic stuff here. Just look in the radio tent, ooh.
Yeah. Well, yeah, a nice example of chaos is the way this show was run, because actually we wanted to have a short roundup on cultural shocks and stuff.
Yeah.
But, well, the timetable is floating and, well, Ingo, maybe you want to say something about that.
Well, it's about the system this radio is organized. So there are time shifts when some people have to make their shows, but sometimes it can happen that something goes wrong, that people are not appearing,
yeah,
and then we have a problem.
They don't turn up.
Then we have to make an emergency program or stuff like this, and we just go in and who can make radio now? There is nobody in. And this happens quite often.
Okay, and this was how we got the idea to make the show. Well, just some more music and then we will see who will take over next.
This is the chaotic radio space station 5.
No, it's not.
It's intergalactic?
No, it isn't. It's what's the name?
Sabisa Radio,
right.
Sabisa Radio. And yeah, that was about German Vereins and culture shocks as far from us. A big goodbye.
Yeah, goodbye from Jens.
Goodbye from Gabriel.
And the next talk will be, well, we will have a short interview, and after this, Nika and Sam, I think, will take over and make the rest of the show.
Yeah, and we will hear a live DJ set from DJ Joyrider.
Yes, yeah, also we have a DJ here again. All this after the short interview and all this after this music. It's Radio Sub-Ether here, and now we have another interview. And yeah, you are doing the interview. Tell us what we do.
Yes, hello. I'm Martina. I'm visitor of the camp here, and I was in a very interesting lecture tonight at 8 o'clock in Tent A with Gerhard Wisniewski and Matthias Bröckers. And we have Gerhard Wisniewski here, who is telling us about his book about the 11th of September. Gerhard Wisniewski, thank you for coming.
Hi.
Could you please tell the listeners what are you doing, what are you working, and why did you wrote this book?
Yes, I'm a freelance German journalist for about 20 years now, and one of my main subjects in all these years was faked terrorism. And 13 years ago I did another book on that subject, the first book what was written in Germany on that subject, that's called The RAF Phantom. This book deals with the so-called Red Army faction in Germany. And in that book, already 13 years ago or 12 years ago, I tried to look for evidence that the third generation of the so-called RAF did the deeds they were blamed for. And this was the beginning for the research on faked terrorism or staged terrorism, and this is the main subject of my new book, Operation 9/11, which deals with the attacks of September 11 in New York and Washington.
Okay, but what was the difference in your work for this book now about the 11th September? Because there was a lot of information, a lot of people who wrote about this. Why did you meant that it was needful to make a new aspect of this?
Yes, there are a lot of information, especially in the internet, thousands of very, very interesting sites on that assassinations and these attacks on September 11, but on the book side, and I always try to get the internet information also to another public who is reading books mainly or reading print media, and therefore I found it useful to get some of the informations out of the internet in a book. And what is lacking here in Germany and worldwide on the print media sector is a whole criminalistic investigation on September 11, and that is that what I try to do.
How did you get all the information it's all about in the internet, or did you have any difficulties during your work in advance for this book?
No, we had no difficulties. I didn't only research in the internet, but I was also in the United States for doing a documentary for the WDR here in Germany. There we talked to witnesses on the places of the attacks, and they confirmed also many, many informations out of the internet. So there was a sort of confirmation of that informations out of the internet also.
Okay. Could you give us a short resume about the content of the book for people who wasn't at this lecture?
Yes. As I told you, I try to do a criminalistic sort of investigation on the attacks of 9/11. And I tried to investigate step by step the different parts of these four attacks on that day. And I tried to describe, for example, what the so-called hijackers did. I looked for the identification of the so-called victims, that is the passengers. So the questions, where were passengers found at all, how were they identified, but more important, were hijackers found in the planes and the wrecks, and how were they identified. And so one main result is that no hijackers were identified in the plane wrecks, and this is one of the main results of the book.
You gave us also the theory of the hijackers. Could you please explain this?
The hijacked hijackers. I'm not sure whether this expression is whether I made this expression. Could you explain that for me first?
So it was a theory of the flights of the two
bit too, was heißt denn, a bit too, Flugzeuge?
Planes?
Airplanes. Two airplanes, the changing of the two airplanes.
The changing of the two airplanes, yes. Some people on the internet had the suspicion that an old American military operation was used on 9/11. Is that the thing you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But there were no hard hints or evidence for that this operation was used. It's called Operation Northwoods. And this operation deals with planes that are changed or exchanged in the sky during flight. And the thing behind that is the suspicion that no human pilots steered the planes really in the World Trade Center, because this would be not 100% reliable. And what I try to do is to find some hints or hard evidence that the planes of 9/11 were really changed during flight, so that passenger jets started or departed from the airports, and that in reality remotely controlled drones went into the World Trade Center. And there I found some evidence on that. For example, that the transponder codes were changed of the planes. That means that different planes were in the sky and on that day. And some very strange deviations in the routes of the airliners or the courses. And from that you can imagine that probably really the planes were changed in the sky.
Mm. You have also told us that the data of the flights are not really logical for terrorists who want to hit the target immediately. Can you tell us why?
You mean the data of the flight? What does it mean?
That they are not flights straightly to the.
Yes, the routes. The problem of the routes. This is my second evidence that the planes were changed, because they made some very strange loops. From the moment they were allegedly hijacked, they didn't go immediately to the targets, but they made some very, very strange loops in the very wrong direction, away from the targets. And this is a very luxury process for hijackers, who have to take into account that they would be followed by fighter jets. And my suspicion is that here we have a very different phenomenon, that is that one plane goes off from the course and the other plane enters the course. And the other plane would be the remotely controlled drone.
Why do you think the other media people didn't found this kind of information and didn't ask these questions too?
I think that unfortunately the main media all over the world is controlled so far, and I think everybody is able to make this observation in everyday life. We can see that the main media follows only the official version of these events, no matter how absurd or grotesque this official version is. And why do they do it? I don't know. If I had an explanation for that, I would feel better, I think.
Okay, your book is a few weeks out. What was the reaction of the public?
The readers are the reader reaction is very, very positive. They are shocked by the information I gave in that book. They are frightened by these informations because I think it's frightening enough if you think of the September 11 as an authentic event made by Islamic terrorists, but it's even more frightening if you think of September 11 as an event steered by forces inside the US. This is more frightening than the original, the official version. And I think that is the reason for this reader's reaction here, who were very, very frightened by that hypothesis in my book.
What do you think? Will there be other books? Are there any other questions open?
Yes, there are thousands of questions open, and fortunately we have more books on that. I'm very glad that we have more books on that, but because I think this is far too much for one journalist, this question, and I also couldn't clear any question on September 11. It's a special election of subjects here, and I'm very glad that I have colleagues here like Matthias Bröckers or Andreas von Bülow, who deal with somewhat different questions of that problem.
Okay, we have to hurry up because you have to go. So I have a few questions left. What was the reaction of the Chaos Camp audience tonight, and is it different to other people?
Yes, it is different, as it is it's very much younger than the audience what I met last here in Berlin in the Humboldt University.
You told us there were some difficulties during your lectures at the Humboldt University. Could you tell us why?
Yes, it was a very strange event because from my point of view, somebody sent in as first a pseudo right-wing person, and 5 minutes later there was a pseudo left-wing person who was angry about that right-wing person, and immediately we had a little staged scandal there, which looked very, very artificial to me. And the result was that people like me or Matthias Bröckers were blamed that we had here a right-wing audience or something. And this was an attempt, obviously, to disturb the evening, that evening, and also to bring us in a connection with right-wing people. But I don't think, and I don't hope so, that this will be of success.
What was the most asked question about your book?
The most asked question. I think there are many, many questions about that book and the project. For example, one very important question is concerning the Operation Northwoods, the model that here the original passenger jets landed on a secret base and were substituted by drones. So many people are asking me, what about the original passengers here? The people are frightened by that, and I unfortunately we can't answer that so far. That that question needs very much more research, and we only know that the original operation, the military operation, Operation Northwoods, which was maybe used here on September 11, that this operation was planned for aliases, for people with wrong names in the planes, and that after the landing they would return to their original lives. But we don't know what kind of passengers we have here. Maybe they did exist only on papers, on lists, and the other possibility is that they were totally authentic, or we have a cocktail of all of that in that four planes.
Okay, will there be any translation for foreign language speaking people?
I hope so. My little speech from that evening is a paper I will pass over to my editor here in Munich, and they will try to go with that English paper to introduce the project and the book in foreign speaking languages.
Okay, and I think the people who are interested can buy a book at the information desk or in any other bookstore.
Yes, here at the camp. I hope so that some people will buy it, and it's not so expensive.
Okay, I thank you for coming here, and bye-bye.
Thank you, bye.
Yes, and here on Subisa Radio, we have a time shift now. We have a live DJ here, and it's DJ Andrenalin, who will go on with the show within the next hours. And also we have a couple of interviews that are following up with Sneaker and Sam.
And this is Music by DJ Joyrider. Nika here in the studio, and with me is Vic. I will be talking to him now for a couple of minutes, because he's a very interesting person also in the CCC life, because he is one of the founding members, but also he just has been in Baghdad as a UN inspector, and I think he can tell us a lot of interesting facts or stories about this time. Vic, first of all, what many people I guess would like to know, how did you get chosen, or did you have to apply for this job, or how did you get into this crew?
Well, this is a process of international bureaucracy, I would say. It's the UN asks its member states to submit experts for specific fields, and the member states use their foreign offices to look for experts, and that's how they came to my company, the company I'm employed with, and how they came to me as an expert for the field of computer forensics and data recovery.
So you've also had a personal sort of interest already in this field. I think you also have your own company with doing forensic work.
No, that's not right. That's not right. I own a company, actually, but it is not the company I work with, so that's a little bit difficult. I am working for a Norwegian company, actually, in the data recovery and computer forensic field, and I own another service company in Hamburg, which does something completely different. And I have been working there when I joined, after I joined the Chaos Computer Club, and I still own the company, but I'm not running it myself. I have a general manager employed to do it.
All right. So what was it? I can imagine that there was the challenge had a very appealing aspect for you. What was the main appealing challenge for you to say, okay, I'm going to do this? I mean, was it sort of curiosity to also to go into this country and have a look at what is done there?
I think it's a major principle for a hacker to be curious. I think I'm curious for almost anything. So, I thought it was a great opportunity to have a look into the international political systems, how they work, and to adjust my reality.
And I can imagine life must have been very strange down there. I mean, could you tell us a bit about your days there, how you spend them? Did you have a local office with how many computers? Or?
Well, when you go there, you don't really know what to expect if it's your first mission with the United Nations. And I was pretty nervous before I went there. After arriving there, I was not that nervous anymore, because the nervosity was taken over by professional work. There was a lot of stuff to do because the headquarters had not been completely established, so we were actually setting up our own offices there, and that took so much effort that we didn't have too much time to worry about the surrounding effects.
So I imagine you almost lived in a world as your own, sort of. I mean, did you read the news down there? What was happening? Or?
In the beginning, it didn't completely work. We had problems with the television reception due to missing, let's say, cable splitters and stuff. It was difficult to get there, so we had to fly in everything, and there was a limited transportation capacity. So, but I think the internet, what usual people call the internet, was up and running almost all of the time. It was not real internet, but we had web, and we had a satellite connection to New York, and later on we had one to Italy, where we had a better bandwidth over satellite, and we also had our telephone calls transmitted through that, through those satellite links. So I was somewhat informed, but it's a strange feeling if you're sitting in the midst of it and reading the news.
Were there any moments where you were afraid, or other people in the mission?
Well, this question is difficult to answer. I can only answer it for myself, because I don't like to answer for other people. So there were situations where I felt, let's say, worried. I wouldn't say afraid, or I wouldn't say frightened, but where you got a somewhat strange feeling, because you can't oversee all the situation. So there were moments, yes.
And also, was there a lot of control? I mean, did you feel controlled all the time, or were you in a sort of shelter?
Well, we were in the middle of the world's interest. That means the interest of press, the interest of, let's say, intelligence agencies, interest of, you know, name it. And of course, they were all observing us somehow, as the public was observing us.
Okay, well, thank you very much. That was the first part. Now we have a short break, and after that we'll get back and talk with Rick about his CCC history, which is also very special.